KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. When Lars and the Real Girl made its premiere last fall, it was a movie that people didn't quite know what to make of, except those who saw it loved it. There's a cult of us around, I think, and it's Oscar-nominated screenwriter Nancy Oliver sitting across from me. Nancy, thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've got to ask you what the movie's about, and let's see. You should have it worked down to like a pitch. Pitch me.
It's a movie about a man who's driven by emotional deprivation and loneliness to fall in love with a sex doll. And the story is about how his individual story with Bianca, the sex doll, and how his family and the town around him reacts to having this in their midst.
What fascinates me about Lars and the Real Girl, though, is the way the women, each woman sort of gets a scene and kind of an entrance, and we think we know her, and then we find out we don't at all. And I think about Emily Mortimer's first two scenes. I mean, the great scene she has with him, just sort of bringing him out of the garage and into the house.
Yes, that's one of my favorites.
That's a great scene, and it's really kind of funny, but it's incredibly sort of sweet and melancholy. Again, that you happen to have those two things that kind of balance each other. I mean, it makes me wonder where that comes from for you.
It's kind of, you know, laughing while you're hurting. I think, you know, we all have our troubles in life, and it's one of the ways I've gotten through them is to make something funny out of them, or to, you know, to develop a perspective that allows you to survive them and through your perspective create something better out of it.
I don't know if you're a big fan of Dennis Potter or not, but he did Pennies from Heaven. And I just wondered if that, because that sort of mix too, where you almost expect people to burst into song in Lars and the Real Girl.
Well, do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. It could, yeah, they could have burst into song. But I find that, you know, I come from books as opposed to movies, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Dickens, you get that same sort of feelings. Those rich, rich, funny characters against the background of, you know, appalling poverty and injustice and that kind of. So that's always what I'm aiming for, is to get that full kind of picture. You get it with Balzac. You get it with the heavyweights, I think. Saul Bellow, all those people walk that same kind of line, I think. So it's my ambition to live in that space when it's appropriate to the project.
When you talk about Dickens, though, I mean, there's that incredible sense, though, of anger in Dickens and Balzac too. Just that sense of sort of trying to draw attention to this social injustice, and this is a much calmer atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm coming at it from another angle, because another ambition that I had in the script was to sort of explore the geography of kindness, and to explore to really take a look at a compassion. So that you're not going to, I mean, that my angle was not to go after the anger that's involved in there. And I'm not sure it's anger for Lars anyway, as much as like this sort of vast, liquid kind of loneliness that he lives in. So it's different territory in those terms, but in looking at the way human beings deal with their problems and the way that we truly are, then comedy comes in there.
But the thing that you're talking about that actually seems more like Bellow is that sense of trying to bring people out of their sort of literal or figurative houses, so bring them out of those spheres of loneliness in which they exist. I mean, if we look at Henderson the Rain King, it's very much about bringing this guy out into a world. And what Lars does through his loneliness is brings everybody out of their own loneliness or their own isolation.
Yeah, it's a cooperative thing in Lars that in the process of bringing himself out of his own loneliness, which is what he does, that other people who have not even noticed that he's in such bad shape also discover things as well. So that was kind of my, I wouldn't call it a twist, but it was something that I was after in the writing of it.
It's the tribute. My guest is the Oscar-nominated screenwriter Nancy Alver, her screenplay of Lars and the Real Girl. I guess I find myself wondering, because people tend to not actually talk about the women in the movie, and they're much stronger. It's about their own kind of, in almost everybody's maternal reaction to Bianca.
Yes, it's true. That was also calculated, or not calculated, but considered in the design of the piece. In that part of what drives Lars is, you know, his mother died when he was born, so he's been completely deprived of that kind of female energy and any kind of nurturing, or that we all have, that isn't gender identified necessarily, but he has such a hunger for a woman, and that this is the way that he goes after it, and that not to set up a matriarchy, but to the women in his life, the strong presence and strong effect that they have on him, and the strength of, you know, active, loving, really going at it, which was what Emily Mortimer does and Kelly Garnett and Patricia Clarkson too in their roles. They actively seek to love this guy and to warm him up. And I was interested in how that would look, you know, in a scene or in the context of the story.
I guess so, because when watching it again, I was really sort of struck how these women all become kind of mother figures. So this town becomes, I think, actually a matriarchy in a way that it had not before. The women sort of come together first, and then the men have to sort of be pulled out of their shells or pulled out of their own passivity to become a part of this.
Right, exactly. I would agree with that. I think it's women-based. It's funny, in articles here and there, people always talk about the doll. They write about Bianca, and there have been articles about how she represents what's wrong with American, the way women are treated in American comedies and things like that. But it's sometimes surprising to me that they don't notice the strong women's roles that really anchor the piece. I mean, Emily Mortimer's role is absolutely at the center of it. She's just as strong a character as Lars for me. By this act of loving on purpose this lonely boy, that everyone finds the ability, not everyone in the town, but everyone we see who matters in the story, finds it in themselves to do that, and how it changes them.
I just wonder, because we should say that Emily Mortimer plays his sister-in-law, and was she always pregnant in the script? Because
yes.
that seems to be a, I wonder how she would have reacted to him, that character, had she not been about to become a mother herself.
Yeah, I think it was built into the story that, you know, this is one of the things that helps drive Lars over the edge, is his fear of what this pregnancy will do to his sister-in-law, whom he loves very much, even though he can't express it, and his fear that she'll die.
And it's funny, too, because he seems passive, but he's a real catalyst. I mean, that's a real shrewd
Lars,
piece of calculation. Absolutely.
Yes. He's very active in his own he's very creative. He's very resourceful in seeking his own recovery from – he doesn't – for him, I feel like it's a matter of life and death, that if he didn't do something, he would die of loneliness. And so – and he doesn't want to die. And he's capable of love, so he goes after it. He wants to live, and this is part of what he does to survive.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Nancy Alver. Her screenplay for Lars and the Real Girl got her an Academy Award nomination. I find myself in watching and thinking that a lot of, especially the scenes of the women, play as if they could be theater. What playwrights were influences on you? I wonder. Pinter?
You know, I spent some time with Pinter, Beckett more than Pinter.
Well, certainly there's a kind of absurdity here that lends itself to Beckett,
definitely.
Doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. I was always drawn to his vision, even though, you know, parts of the plays are sometimes hard to get through. You have to kind of work at it. I mean, because I feel like, you know, Pinter comes off of Beckett. But, I spent a lot of time, and it's going to sound pretentious, but it's the truth. I spent a lot of time with Shakespeare. I did spend a lot of time with Shakespeare in college.
With the comedies?
Everything. I had sort of a curriculum in college that, you know, for over a span of 3 years, it was a lot of taking Shakespeare apart, analyzing it, putting it back together, seeing it in production, that kind of thing. You know, his dialogue has such force and power. So there are things there. I'm more like a classic. I'm more drawn to the classic structures. You can see from the simplicity of Lars and the way that it moves along that it's that I hope that it reads as a classic fable.
But there's that sense in a lot of Shakespeare of indirection, of sort of prestidigitation, if you will, where people are kind of talking around what they're actually trying to get at.
Yeah, you can be very oblique and very indirect. And
which kind of happens here, too. I mean, people...
I hope so.
Because people because it's that thing where nobody can actually come out and say that you're insane. You shouldn't be talking to an inanimate object.
Well, it wouldn't do them any good. I think there were scenes in the movie that were cut where that did show, you know, people in the town who had difficulty with him or they were mean to him. But in the end, it didn't matter to his story because he made himself oblivious to those people. So it would have been a comfort point for the audience. But in terms of Lars's own particular story, they were irrelevant.
See, I like that you said comfort point to the audience because until the end, the audience doesn't really get a way out.
Right. Yeah. There's a tension created there that I was sort of after as well. And it made some people very uncomfortable. And, you know, the people who don't like the film, often that's what it's connected to.
How do you mean?
We're used to fantasies of unrelieved violence. We're used to that. I know I am. But we're seldom exposed to the unrelieved tension of compassion and kindness without sentimentality. And I think that creates a tension in a viewer. You're like, okay, when is he going to cut up the doll and throw it in the lake? When is somebody going to murder somebody?
And the thing that I think people are trying to say about it is there's not that moment of declamation where everything is explained in the movie.
Oh, God, I hope not. I wrote away from that so hard. I just didn't, you know, I didn't want anything explained.
But you must have found that you were backed into corners sometimes, or the script in that sort of sense of us having expectations almost demanded that there be somebody declaiming or just explaining things away, and you had to get away from that to make a severe left or right turn to get away from that place you were going to.
Yeah, absolutely. It happened unconsciously, so I can't really...
Really? It was unconscious for you?
I knew what I wanted. I had the big goals in place. I knew that I never wanted a declamation. I didn't want a soliloquy, and I didn't want explanations or, you know, huge chunks of exposition just laid out. So in trying to achieve all that, then scene by scene, you go after it.
Because that's the thing that I feel people are leaning for and waiting for and hoping for, that moment that you tend to get in a lot of the indie sort of films that feel like sitcoms, because you finally do get that moment of sort of explanation, that tap on the side of the beaker that explains everything. And you never, even when the conclusion comes, you never offer that kind of relief in the script.
No. I mean, and again, I think it's we're used to the rhythm of that kind of story. We're used to the first act laying it out and the second act complicating it and the third act resolving it. And I find that rhythm tedious at times, and I didn't want it to be predictable, and I wanted it to follow its own path outside of traditional structure, even though the structure at the same time is classic.
We have to take a break. My guest is Nancy Oliver. Her screenplay for Lars and the Real Girl got an Oscar nomination. We will talk more about her reflexive contrariness. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is screenwriter Nancy Oliver, who wrote the script for Lars and the Real Girl. There's something I want to ask you that, I mean, you know how aware you are of this, but the number of the screenplays that have made impacts, movies that have made impact this year, yours and Juno and No Country for Old Men, are movies that feel in their way kind of timeless, that they're not set in any kind of specific period. And we don't know where we are. And I wondered for you how conscious that was, a decision to sort of make it feel like it could be any time. But there are certain sort of modern things that we don't really see in the film. Like nobody really talks about television or cell phone or anything like that.
Right. It was very conscious on my part. I wanted to, strip the language of any kind of pop reference. Or I wanted a timeless classic piece that it you can tell from the clothes that they're wearing – vaguely what decade they're in. But even that, you know, it came out looking not like a – even a little like a period piece almost.
Because what that also offers the audience – or rather deprives the audience too of making standard kind of connections
exactly,
to it. And
yeah.
What you're saying to the audience is you've got to enter this. I'm not going to make it easy for you.
Well, I mean there's a certain amount of – the movie's not coming to you. You come to the movie. And that's, you know, sometimes depending on the project. For this project, I felt that was the correct approach. I don't feel like everything I write is going to be that way. But in this, I felt like, yeah, you come to the movie.
Because I wonder if for you this felt like a reaction to the kinds of things that you'd seen and maybe the kinds of things you've been offered and things you worked on before, that you wanted to create a piece that existed in its own sphere.
Yes, I definitely wanted to create something that was not in a bubble necessarily, because you don't want that feeling of inaccessibility.
But it's kind of like on an island, though.
I mean, it's a different space. It's a world outside a world within a world, you know, because it is a fable that to exist in a place outside of our conventional ideas of reality.
Because it's a place where people have to really go inside, not only inside these spaces, but inside themselves to find some warmth. I mean, they got to come in from the gray. Wintry outside that reminds me so much of Western Massachusetts this time of year, that kind of inescapable of not only cold, but there's no sunlight anywhere.
Right. It's just gray. I mean, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and I grew up in outside of Boston and went to school in Western Massachusetts. So I have this weather in my bones, and it's one of the reasons I live in California now.
But there's a kind of spiritual chill that the characters have to fight.
Yeah, there's that and the isolation of that winter isolation and the constant cold and the slush and it was the right physical and psychological landscape for this particular story.
How long did it take you to write this?
It took 5 years of thinking and 9 months of writing.
5 years of thinking.
Well, it was like kicking around in my head. And I was also in the process of learning how to write a screenplay and changing forms coming from plays. Writing for movies, for me in particular, I had to learn different ways to perceive things and to interpret things in my mind visually, and it was a lot of work. So, and that took me about 5 years.
Well, one of the things that it really suggests is an ear for writing for actors, and for writing for two actors in a room, that must come from your theatrical background.
Oh yeah, definitely. I was always a dialogue person. I mean, even in reading the novels and everything, I would skip over those long descriptive parts and get to where people were talking. So yeah, that's what really interests me. And you try to just keep developing your ear. And for Lars in particular, taking the writer out of the language till it sounds so natural and so casual that it doesn't feel written.
It's the treatment, my guest, the screenwriter Nancy Oliver, who wrote the screenplay for Lars and the Real Girl. I'm aware of it in the scenes with Patricia Clarkson, which must have been very hard to write because you can't, as a psychiatrist, you can't have her leading him at all. She's got to like let him come to these conclusions on her own. And those struck me as being particularly difficult passages to write.
They were actually, and it was – her character was the character that I had the most trouble with. It started out as two people and then
– Two different psychiatrists?
Two different characters. There was a regular like general practitioner and then there was a psychologist. But it just was not coming together. And so I went back in and rebuilt and joined this character and created this new woman out of it and then started to get a handle on how I wanted those scenes to play out. But yeah, they're very oblique. You know, you write the basic scene and then you get it more and more indirect in the rewriting of it.
But those are the scenes in which I found myself aware of how active a character he was.
Uh-huh.
And that fascinated me because And I think that's the real genius in the work, that it's very subtle, almost insidious, in fact, in this interaction
right.
with the other characters. But with her, there's this sense of ambition of wanting to pull himself out of this and not knowing how to do it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's completely what I was going for. And there's also a level of the film where I feel like this character, by falling in love with a sex doll, bringing it into the center of town life, he's actually confronting his entire community with his loss, with the fact that they've neglected, you know, in a benign way, neglected him. He's putting it right out there, how the way they live has helped due to him. Do you know what I mean?
Sure,
it's a confrontational mental illness.
Just the way that that town works or doesn't work, its own dysfunction and that isolation that the town creates has helped to create what he is.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. Thank you.
But part of it for me feels like this screenplay must have been a reaction for you to how few ensemble pieces there are that give women a crucial part in the work. I mean, I don't know if it's conscious or not, but I was very aware in watching it that this is a movie where the women are the driving forces, and they certainly are part of an ensemble. And there actually is, even though he's the center, there really is no leading character in it, I
right.
think.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that they all work together. It wasn't conscious in terms of being a particular goal. I was wrapped up in the story. But in creating this story, I expressed my feelings about the place of women in the world, and I always want to work with women when I write. I didn't say, I want to write this story because there need to be more women's roles. I wrote the story that had these women's roles so that they were organic to it, and that, that female, that nurturing energy, whether it comes from a female or a male, is at the heart of the piece.
And that makes the women characters feel ambitious, too, because they're really working to try to make something happen to bring about changes. I mean, you got the older women who are almost sort of like the Greek chorus.
That's exactly what they are. They were that, in my mind, that scene where they're sitting with him and three of them are doing needlework. You know, it's like the Fates knitting his life together. I mean, that was the most kind of one of my more obvious symbols. But, yeah, that's definitely how I felt about it.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to Nancy Oliver, who wrote the screenplay for Lars, the original screenplay for Lars and the Real Girl, we should say. But I'm struck by that because that gives it – those women give it a real classical setting for me. That's where I see the certainly the Shakespearean aspect that you were talking about. But he is almost, to me, like Prince Hal in some ways. I mean, he's sort of this floating figure who's looking for some place to live.
That's another thing, yeah. I agree with you. He's creating a world. He's creating himself, and he's creating a world, and deciding who he's going to be in it, which is a very Prince Hal kind of thing.
But generally, in that kind of construction, you got somebody. You're almost begging for a Hotspur or somebody to rub up against, and you very consciously don't do that here.
Right. Exactly. I didn't want it to be with a classic conflict-based piece. I wanted to do something different, more Eastern a little bit, where you didn't – again, that's something that we're used to. We're used to seeing this character up against this character and I wanted a more subtle and pervasive kind of conflicts that weren't so obvious.
Well, how active were you on the set? Were you there with the actors all the time, or is it –
I was there the whole time. I was more of an observer. I mean, if there was a point for discussion, if they invited a contribution, if they asked what I thought, I was there to do that. But I wasn't there to participate in the. There just isn't time for the director to deal with everybody else and me and my ideas. So I went up there with that understanding.
Did it ever occur to you to direct it? Did that ever? Was there something you wanted to do?
I wasn't. Well, you know, I directed in theater directed my own stuff in theater for actually the whole trip, all those years that I worked there. So, directing is on my mind, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to do this particular piece.
But was it tough to let go? I mean,
because, oh, absolutely. It's always tough.
Sure. I mean, because forget the investment of time itself, but the obviously the kind of emotional investment you had in this, that must have been incredibly tough to sort of say, here, you take this and do what you will with it.
Yeah, and I was very lucky because everyone was so respectful of and considerate and protective of the script, which I actually didn't expect. But, you know, you're on the set and it's really tense and things are going and scenes are unfolding in ways that you didn't anticipate. And so I would just like walk around the block and cry for a while and then go back to the camera. But no, it's not in a bad way in like that broadcast news way, just like blow out the tension and then go back there. It was actually a wonderful experience. It was a great adventure. It wasn't easy, but it was a lot of fun.
And when Ryan first came in, Ryan Gosling, how aware were you of his work up until that point?
Well, you know, when his name came up, I was like, I went and saw everything that he had done, and I saw The Believer, and I thought, you know, this kid is really good. Can he be funny? That was my worry. But then, you know, he had attacked that role with such intelligence that you figure if they're smart enough, he'll know what to do, and he clearly did.
But it's tricky because, I mean, certainly you see The Believer, and I guess he hadn't done Half Nelson at that point, but the other things he had done, you wouldn't have a sense of him being as patient as he needs to be.
Right. Yeah, it's always a crapshoot, but he threw himself into the role with such commitment that it was always fresh with him, and he surprised me every day. Even when I, you know, didn't agree with him or something, there was still a sense of surprise in him working all the time. And I felt that with all the actors as well. They were extremely intelligent group, very intelligent.
Well, speaking of surprise, does it surprise you how much people really love it? I mean, because people really embrace this thing and take it into their hearts.
Yeah, it does. And to tell you the truth, it hasn't really even sunk in so much yet because, you know, I read a few reviews at the beginning, but they just kind of mess with your head. And, of course, I kind of just remember the bad ones. So I've steered clear of it. And so it's always a delight when somebody tells me, you know, that the movie touched them or moved them. Or it's just an eternally fresh pleasure.
Well, it is, because finally what the movie is, in so many of these cases, it's about that Shakespearean thing, an act of will. You know, uh-huh. You have to exercise will to move yourself into whatever place you need to be.
Yes, and that's exactly what Lars does. And so, I mean, the town around him participates, but he drives it. He drives it beginning to end with his imagination and his creativity and his desire to live a full life as a whole man.
We're out of time. Thank you so much for doing this, Nancy.
My total pleasure. Thank you.
My guest is Nancy Oliver. Her original screenplay for Lars and the Real Girl got her an Academy Award nomination. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We call this Cloud Cuckoo Land, The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.